Good morning to Merlin. He's in England, I'm in Maine, and we're having a conversation about mushrooms in celebration of his newly released, beautifully bound book called The Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures. This is his first book, but he's been studying mushrooms through very accredited pathways, and I'm sure he's created new pathways through the fungal mind view. Now, Merlin, why did you decide to write a book at such a time as this?
That's a good question. I'd never planned to write a book. I was doing research on mycorrhizal fungal networks in the tropical forests in Panama. And at some point, a friend of mine persuaded me to write a book. And then I was reluctant. And then I reluctantly said yes. One thing led to the next, and it all just happened.
Well, I can report that even in May, when galloping continuously from 5 a.m. until dark, I could even make it through 25 pages a night because it's so well written. So there you are in Panama, hanging out with this cohort of field biologists, studying what's a cousin of what we have here in Maine, the ghost pipe mushroom. Let's leap right into the middle of the subject. Can you explain what's going on in between the roots?
Yeah, so the ghost pipe plant, rather than a mushroom, or Monotropa, as it's known, it's part of a larger group of plants called mycoheterotrophs. It's an unfortunate name because it's a mouthful and it's an unlovely description for what are very charismatic plants. And mycoheterotrophs are called mycoheterotrophs because they depend for fungi on their nutrition. And most of them have lost the ability to photosynthesize. So Monotropa, as anyone who will have seen it will know, is a pale white, hence the ghost plant, and can grow in deeply shaded parts of the forest understory where most other plants have trouble. And it can do this because it doesn't have need for light. It's renounced this ancient plant habit of photosynthesis. And instead, it draws carbon compounds, energy-containing carbon compounds and nutrients from its mycorrhizal fungal partners. But because its mycorrhizal fungal partners depend on green synthesizing plants for their energy-containing carbon compounds, the energy that arrives in Monotropa must have originally started in another plant, in a green plant. So Monotropa, they suck nutrition from other plants through fungal networks and into themselves. And so I think of the mycoheterotrophs as hackers of the wood wide web, because they've somehow worked out how to bypass this normal part of the mycorrhizal relationship, which is an exchange. The plant receives from the fungus mineral nutrients from the soil, and the fungus receives from the plant these energy-containing carbon compounds. And it's an exchange, carefully regulated exchange. But in this case of mycoheterotrophs, the plant doesn't seem to participate in an exchange. It just receives from the fungus and doesn't seem to give anything back. So I think of them as these hackers. And they're very interesting plants because they show that an entire way of life is possible, just extracting nutrients and energy from fungal networks and without needing to recourse to photosynthesis.
Well, and it strikes me that there's a kind of iconic quality to this behavior, or the phenomenology or life way of this class of organism expresses something that is out of the ordinary for those of us acculturated in the transactional economy of, quote, the money system, wherein you give and you get, and there is some kind of moral tone to how that is right and true and following some law, and that there's something kind of off step about this life form being in something, some kind of a transaction that defies that kind of classification. And there's some reciprocity somewhere probably to be found, but that maybe it's temporally disjointed or it's happening on a different plane, question mark. Has the reciprocity or the mutualism that might flow both ways been discovered yet, or is that the site of inquiry?
So it's a big site of inquiry. You jump straight to the most interesting point, which is great, which is that for Monotropa, it's normally assumed to be a parasite, that is, an organism that disadvantages its host, and its host in this case is the fungus. So it's normally assumed that Monotropa is parasitic on the fungus and thus epiparasitic on the plants that the fungus is connected to, the other plants that the fungus is connected to. But this is just an assumption, because to show that it's parasitic, you have to show that the Monotropa is disadvantaging the fungus, and that's really difficult to show experimentally. So at the moment, that's in the realm of assumption. And although it's not giving something back in this kind of transactional, chemical, nutritional exchange, it doesn't mean that it's not giving something back in a completely different kind of currency that we're just not taking into account. So my personal feeling is that there's something that the Monotropa is doing for the fungus, but because our view has been too narrow about these nutrient economies, we just haven't taken into account the other ways, for example, as shelter in the soil, that these plants might be providing all sorts of benefits to the fungus. So that's an open question. There are cases where, as you say, the payback is, if we want to keep on using these economic terms, the payback is temporally shifted. So some types of fern, for example, have a juvenile and an adult stage, and the juvenile stage is nourished by the adult stage through shared connections. It's a kind of parental care in plants mediated by fungus. And you have cases where green plants receive, like many orchids, receive nutrition through fungal networks when they're young, and when they're older and have more ability to photosynthesize, then they start to put nutrients back into the fungal network. So it's a kind of, some people refer to that as a take now, pay later approach. So yeah, there are a number of ways around this question. But the main point, coming back to the Monotropa thing, is that we don't actually know right now what the plant could be doing for the fungus, because the fungus is so hard to observe and experiment on in the field, in the forest.
Which, of course, is a wonderful place to be as a scientist and as a human in a time of unknowing, bound up in a destiny we do not understand, and in touch with how profoundly limited our knowledge is, might also give us the humility to be hopeful when confronted with a lot of bad news. And I guess I wonder what your posture is as a scientist about. What transmission do you hope to make with this book from the mushrooms to the people, as it were, about ways of being that might, I don't want to say help us survive, but help us survive?
A good question. So firstly, I would say fungi rather than mushrooms, because mushrooms are just the fruiting bodies of a very small proportion, actually, of the fungal kingdom in general. So the fungal world is far bigger than mushrooms. But if we turn to history, there have been some interesting moments where the way that we think and the way that we treat the world have changed because of fungal behaviors. For example, in the 19th century, it was in the study of lichens, and lichens are this symbiosis between a fungus and a photosynthesizing bacteria or an alga. And it was in the study of lichens, through the study of lichens, that this word symbiosis was coined. Because before the study of lichens at this moment, before the discovery of this dual nature of lichens, there was no way to describe the intimate sharing of bodily space apart from as parasitism or disease. And so this word symbiosis opened up this unprejudiced way of thinking about intimate relationships in nature, and change the way that we think and approach the world, at least in modern Western scientific thinking. And so I think of that as an example of the way that fungi can loosen the grip of some of our categories and open up new avenues of thought. And I think that's entirely possible, that we could have this kind of thing happen again and again. So some of the many interesting questions that fungi raise right now are those of a decentralized behavior. They coordinate their behavior across large sprawling networks, but without a central place to do so. And there are a lot of plants that are similar. They have no single point, which is a brain, no centralized control. And yet they're able to perform sophisticated tasks and solve sophisticated problems, or solve problems in sophisticated ways. So this idea of decentralization, and this is something that humans can think about a little bit more. I think the current situation, this current pandemic, has revealed how fragile our systems are when they're centralized, when we just have a couple of handful of monopolies and centralized systems, centralized food distribution, centralized economies. All of these systems are incredibly fragile. And at the moment, that is particularly visible. And so in designing robust systems, systems robust to damage and perturbation, and possibly even systems that get stronger through damage and perturbation, I think fungi and fungal networks have a lot to teach us.
When I listened to this morphic resonance business, and I listened and I thought about young farmer survival and young farmer confidence, about being able to start farms and having more confidence in knowing that other people have started farms and being able to better adapt and respond because of all that has been transmitted through the culture and through the medium of our kinship between and amongst us. And often in gatherings, which we no longer are having, you know, right now, we're not having human connection gatherings. So it's almost like we may need to rely more on the fungal network of intuition and esoteric types of intercommunion to feel each other's presence and feel each other's response and responsiveness. Well, I guess we still have the internet. That wasn't a question at all, but why don't you respond?
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good question to think about the ways that we are able to connect. Like, what are the ways that we are able to connect with systems that are bigger than us, or that are even smaller than us, but or in which we're embedded? And one way we can do that is using the internet, as you say, but the internet depends on cables. And cables depend on people maintaining cables. And internet depend on servers and internet service providers. And, you know, it's just not actually a very, it's a vulnerable system. It's vulnerable like everything else. And so, so are there other ways that we can connect? And I think that there absolutely are. And many of these are very well known through societies and traditions for going back millennia. So, for example, spiritual practices, we can think of spiritual practices as separate from, or along, sort of bracketed off somewhat from religion, because spiritual practices you can think of as things that are done in various religious contexts, but which themselves don't imply a particular credo. But for example, in many places around the world, people pray and have done for a long time. People meditate, people sing together, people connect with or form relationships with plants or animals. There are lots of ways that these spiritual practices lead us out of ourselves and allow us to form connections with other organisms and with our environment. And the word spiritual comes from the Latin espiritu, which means breath. And as we breathe, we form the most ongoing and ever-present connection with our atmospheric environment. And it's inescapable. You have air that enters you, perfuses your tissues, and then leaves again. And this continual, this inflow and outflow of air is a very literal connection with our atmospheric and chemical environment. So we are embedded in inextricable ways in our surroundings. So I think the ways that practices that can help us connect with more than us are those practices that are perhaps worth thinking about in this time of trying to nourish and explore new ways of connecting across space.
So all of these spiritual communities, spiritual lineages, the whole rainbow of anthropological study that shows us how many human societies make meaning and perceive more deeply into their world through the portal of altered consciousness, made possible through the fungal and other psychoactive pathways. In speaking with all of these mushroomy humans, do you sense in them a stronger kind of confidence in their own organoleptic or prophetic sensing? Do you sense that they're learning from their interactions with mushrooms to be more fluid in their own sensing? Like what Stamets and Peter McCoy say, that mycelium is running through the earth with its mouth wide open, you know, pumping with liquid. Tell us more about mycelium and what it is structurally and how it works.
Yeah, so that might be good to cover that. So mushrooms are just the fruiting bodies of fungi. So most fungi live their lives as networks of tubular cells. And these networks of tubular cells are called mycelium. So mycelium is a generic term for a growth form, a network growth form, that most fungi spend most of their time in this phase. And it's the way that fungi feed. So animals digest things inside their bodies. So animals tend to find food, put it inside their body, and inside their body it's digested and absorbed. But fungi do it the other way around. Fungi find food and put their bodies in the food. And they digest the food outside themselves and absorb it once it's digested. So they have an entirely different nutritional logic. And mycelium is the way, the most efficient way for them to behave in this way, because it allows them to insinuate themselves within their food source. And of course, because their food sources can vary from in size and shape and different places and different seasons, they have to be flexible in their body plans, because they have to be able to deal with completely new types of food and new shapes and sizes of food. And so mycelium is a body without a body plan. So it's this very fluid way of existing. You have no preset, determinate limits of the body. You have this ability to thicken and branch, and also to prune and withdraw parts of the network. So this is, in a nutshell, the mycelial lifestyle.
And so the mycelia depend on this discovery process in a way that is super different from the animal kingdom. And then I go back to my earlier question, which is, have you discovered in the behavior of the mushroom-affiliated humans something of a similar capacity, or maybe just comment generally on the typology of these mushroom-affiliated humans that you discovered along your wonderful journey?
It's a really good question and a really good subject. And I think it's a really important thing to raise, because thinking about fungi makes the world look different. There's no question. And so the people that think about the fungi, to them, the world might look different from people who don't think about fungi. And you'd expect to see that reflected in their behaviors and their attitudes towards other people and towards the modern human world. And one way that I've noticed this happening is that So this idea of ecology, you know, ecology, the relationships between organisms and their surroundings, and their relationship between organisms and the other organisms on which they depend. And so ecology is this idea of networks of relationships, networks of interactions. And it's all very well understanding that in principle, but fungi form these literal connections between organisms. So in a forest, for example, with mycorrhizal fungi, you have literal living connections between plants and trees. In an ecosystem. And so if you're spending time thinking about these living connections, then it's very, very hard to avoid taking this ecological perspective, because you're handling the actual physical connections between these ecosystems. And it's not just an idea, it's not just a concept that, oh yeah, this plant interacts with this pollinator, or this animal interacts with this type of prey. These aren't just passing moments of encounter, they're enduring, living moment-to-moment physical contact. So I think there's an ecological perspective that mycologists or fungal ecologists, anyone who thinks about fungi, tends to have quite close at hand. And I think that is something that often comes across. And then more generally, there's a sort of excitement, and because the more you think about fungi, the less makes sense without them, and the more questions you have, because these organisms are so, they're just so peculiar, and but so important and hiding in plain sight and underpinning so many of the world's processes and huge biogeochemical cycles. And so there's a sense of open-minded questioning. There's a sense of there's so much to find out. There's a sense of often childlike curiosity in people who think about fungi, which I found very welcome. It's very hard to think about fungi for long and to be someone with lots of firm answers because there are just so many questions. So that's another aspect. There are plenty more.
Makes you kind of soggier, more appreciative, more absorbative.
Perhaps. Yeah, perhaps.
When you're going out in the forest and you're looking for mushrooms, as we do here, we have chanterelles a lot, black trumpets, little yellow trumpets. There's Mazutake more down mid-coast. We have reishis, lots of turkeys of the woods, lots of birch polypore, chaga mushrooms. And in following a wonderful forager who will also be part of this myco session through the forest, Evan, I watched him tuning into the pattern of light and the kind of quality of the habitat that he was seeking. And he was moving across the landscape in a very different way to how one generally follows along contours and trails as an animal accustomed to certain trailness. And I noticed we were covering terrain really quickly, but we weren't stumbling very much. But that he was really tuning in and following in this same kind of mycelial way. So that's why I was wondering what you found, and I'm wondering what, having found what you found, you might be tracking as your next inquiry.
That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure, but one thing I want to research more is the way that mycelial networks communicate with themselves. That we know very little about this. We have, you know, you have these sprawling, fusing, branching networks that these body planless bodies, and they're somehow coordinating their behavior everywhere at once and nowhere in particular. And how this happens is quite a big mystery. And one of the most exciting possibilities, in my view, is that many types of fungal network, not all, but many types might be using electrical impulses to coordinate their behavior. There's been a little bit of work done on this. There was a paper published on this in the mid-1990s, and only very recently has it been picked up again. But by inserting microelectrodes into fungal cells, Stefan Olsson, this Swedish researcher, was able to find these pulses of electrical activity analogous to the action potentials that travel down animal nerve cells. And he hypothesized that these rhythmic pulses, electrical impulses, could be used by the fungus as a kind of rapid signaling system, as a way to coordinate its behavior as it ranged across large distances and as it changed shape. And so I think this is a wide open field of research, and it's one of the things that I'm very keen on looking into more. So that's one possibility. But otherwise, it's kind of hard to make any plans right now.
Well, one thing, the more that one studies of life systems and at that frontier of knowledge, is the great mystery and the incredible genius of this evolutionary force of life's unfurling and survival, and the kind of distributed volition of all these beings woven into an interbeing of some. It's so inscrutable how things happen, and it's so it's easy to, as a human, get caught up into logic systems that don't account for the mystery. Well, I already kind of talked about that, but I just like to reiterate, the unknowing is very happy for me in this time, although the knowing that spring is coming in its normal sequence is also very comforting.
Yeah, this interplay of habits and creativity and the comfort that we derive from each, We need always both.
And almost that we that, you know, as soon as I personally stopped tuning into the news channels and the cyclical worrying exchanges with other humans, digitally mediated, and instead I'm tuning to the earth life and the bobolinks and the unfurling shad blossoms and the running of the alewives and what is being transmitted in the natural world, my ears are much more open to positive impulses. I feel more capable of bigger work. Anyway, that's just a happy farmer talking, but.
No, I agree. I agree. I find a very similar thing. After all, the news cycles are designed to grab our attention and to grab our attention by making us worried, making us concerned, generating insecurity. This is not some accident. This is the way you sell stories. So it makes sense that taking a fast from that kind of stimulus or that world of stimuli would allow us to rediscover a whole other world of perception and motivation in ourselves.
So other than reading your book, what guidance and counsel or suggestions and curricula would you propose to our community of busy young farmers who are yet interested in fungal worlds and might, and this is Peter McCoy's big point, form mutualist conspiracy with others, particularly mycophenes? And I say this as someone who has just painted mold-killing paint in an old cabin on the back of ironworks in order to host a mycolab on our agrarian campus here in Maine so that we can host a mycologist and they can clean their nice spores well into media and grow mushrooms. I mean, grow lab cultures and then grow mushrooms. It seems like that's a place of tremendous potential for the mycophenes, but also for the hosting farmers to be co-beneficiaries of your trophic friendship with you guys.
Yeah, I totally agree. And Peter's work is amazing and inspiring. And his book, Radical Mycology, is a kind of one-stop shop for all sorts of fungal information. And I couldn't recommend it more. But this is so exciting, isn't it? This idea that rather than just growing plants, there's a whole other kingdom of life that you can also cultivate. And what's more, that other kingdom of life, these fungi, they produce mushrooms that grow very quickly. And many of these mushrooms can be sold at quite high cost. So it makes these profits. And even better, these fungi like growing on waste materials that you might have lying around the farm anyway. Corn stalks or mulch, manure, straw, whatever. So there's an amazing sense that by working with fungi as a farmer, you're tuning into a different part of the ecological world. And you can, and I love this idea with the fungal cultivators. You're harnessing a waste stream. So the producer of waste, whether it's you or somewhere else, it's a win for the producer of waste because you're getting rid of waste. So a win for the fungal cultivator because you're getting the substrate on which you grow your crop. And it's a win for the fungi because they're getting cultivated and propagated. So there's this amazing way that it closes this trophic loop. So I think it's enormously exciting. There are other possibilities, of course, for farmers and forming partnerships with fungi. After all, almost all plants depend on mycorrhizal fungi, and all plants depend on so-called foliar fungal endophytes, which live inside their leaves and their shoots. And no plant found growing in natural conditions has been found without these fungi. And so are there ways that we can change our farming practices or agricultural practices to think more carefully about the fungal partners of the plants that we cultivate? These plants are ecosystems made up of what we call plant cells, but also what we call fungal cells. I like to think of plants actually as algae that have evolved to farm fungi and fungi that have evolved to farm algae. And so there may be things that we can do as cultivators, new kinds of practices that, or actually more likely, old kinds of practices that nourish these plant relationships with their fungal microbiomes. So that's a big field. It's often the case that traditional farming practices that take account of the life of the soil are the best way to go. But that's a whole world possible exploration. Another one is mycotecture, using fungal building materials from fungal mycelium. This is often done by getting sawdust or corn stalks or some kind of organic waste, and then packing it damp into molds and then letting fungal mycelium run through that slurry. And then you bake these bricks or boards in an oven, and you find that you have this amazing composite material, which grows in just a couple of weeks, again, off a waste material, and produces this very viable building materials. You can also make leather-like materials in this way. And for anyone who was setting up a sustainable farm, the ability to produce out of waste in a week or two, but building materials would be, it strikes me, a great advantage. So I think that's another exciting possibility moving forward.
Well, or I'm thinking about insulation materials. We actually just ordered from Ecovative, which is featured in your book, a company in mm-hmm. Troy, New York. They make that mushroom leather, and they make the mushroom foam, and they make the mycelium cardboard inserts to ship safely the computer through the mail. And they also make this foam, and we have a project looking at alternatives to plastic in aquaculture, because living in such a beautiful, wild, pristine marine environment, it seems a shame, even if oysters have many positive impacts in the water column, putting them in cages coated in PVC with plastic floats that have an algicide baked into the polyvinyl chlorinate doesn't seem very green. So we wrote a grant, and we've been doing material inquiry into alternatives, and especially alternatives that just kind of biodegrade over time as a totally, totally cool way to think about stuff that suspends in the water. And this mushroom foam is, we ordered it. We're going to attach it to our cages. We're going out this weekend in the small boat if the weather doesn't get too sunny. And
that's really exciting.
Yeah, I think that so especially as we're thinking, you know, so many of us are inhabiting old architecture, architecture and decisions, the institutions, the farm systems that we inhabit, the houses, the greenhouses, the solar orientation, the angle of repose of our fields are all defined by the instincts of our predecessors on this land. It's been spring, and it's been a lot of moving of materials around. Agriculture seems to be a lot of moving. Like if you were to look at an ant and you were to look at me, you would say, wow, there's a lot in common. Moving the materials, mulch chips that have become myceliated and are full of white fibers, and moving of spent hay that has become rotted and transformed into slimy, sticky stuff. Moving of the what we call a weed, grass species out of one place and then using it to repair another place. And you see, in doing that by wheelbarrow, you perceive the different biotopes, even on a small farm. So this place that has been mown, this place that has been sheared by sheep grazed by sheep and fertilized a lot, this place that has never gotten those nutrients, this place where the manure was dumped for 20 years. And they each have profoundly different, although different, not very different geological histories, have profoundly different plant communities. And you were saying in your book that we have to sometimes tune ourselves more closely to the impacts we might be having when we transport materials from one ecological community or like tribal cluster of co-associated fungi, algae, microbacteria, microbiome into another area. Can you go a little bit into that subject for those? And where are we who are trying to learn more about how we are interacting in our stewardship decisions with our fungal communities might learn more about that?
That's a very good question.
We're always saying it's a good question, and it's usually a terrible question.
No, maybe we heard your question differently. I think that's a great question. It's one of the most urgent questions facing many people in forestry, in agriculture, in any kind of landscape restoration, is how do we take account of the life of the soil, and how can we facilitate a faster bounce back of these soil communities if they've been ravaged, and is transporting microbiota from one place to another always a good idea? And in some cases, it can be a good idea, and in some cases, less so. So one of the things you see when, if you look on a garden center website or a garden catalog, you can find lots of products, mycorrhizal grow products. And these are often marketed as a kind of one size fits all quick fix. And no doubt some of these products have benefits for some plants grown in some situations, but it's a bit dangerous to think about this mycorrhizal fungi as just all the same, because they're not. And different plants form different relationships with different communities of fungi, and they can have quite different effects depending on where they grow. And so there's an ecological matching of plant communities and fungal communities. So if you just transplant a type of fungus from one place to another and assume that it's going to do good, you might be disappointed. And in fact, it might even do bad, because in that situation, the new situation it finds itself in, these fungi might not get on that well with these plants, or at least the balance of the symbiosis might be shifted. And maybe these fungi will not actually benefit the plants as much as they do in the other situation. So there's a caution there. Maybe an effective way to think about this would be a bit like the way that we think about the human microbiome. And if you go to a health food store and try and buy a human probiotic supplement, the chances are that you'll find something which has been produced, all these bacterial species have been grown, not because they're the most important strains in your gut. Normally they're Z listers in your gut. They're just easy to produce in manufacturing facilities. They're easy to culture. And so those are the ones that get sold. So that's why fecal microbiota transplants, or fecal transplants, are the most effective way to restore health to ravaged human microbiomes, because you're transplanting from a healthy patient an entire intact community, and you're putting that into the gut of someone with a disrupted community. And so maybe when we're thinking about moving microbiota around in environments or in farms or in restoration sites, we could think analogously. So if you're trying to restore a certain type of forest and a certain type of soil in one place with this kind of aspect to the sun or whatever, this kind of bedrock, you might find somewhere, perhaps not too far away, an ecosystem with a maybe further along in this successional process, and you might be able to use the soil from that ecosystem to inoculate the one that you want to kickstart. So there's a kind of ecological matching, a kind of fecal transplant approach, rather than a little pill of two or three or four strains, factory produced strains that may be ecologically irrelevant in the situation you find yourself in. That's one way of thinking about it that I've been playing around with recently.
Well, or even more perverse would be that it's, by the large scale application, I'm thinking about a company called Indigo Ag that has some $1 billion or something of investment that's essentially a cocktail of microbes that's sprayed as a tea on, with the hope of remediating or restoring or renewing or regenerating the soil life of degraded monoculture lands in the land of corn and soy, which you could say, well, that's a laudable goal, but does it kind of construct its own future problems? And so then the question is kind of like, well, we're restoring to what? If we, you know, restoration is obviously laudable also, and you know, what I was moving the other day was these grasses that we weeded out of the potato bed, and I moved them over to where the water line had been put in, and the subsoil was churned up by a bulldozer in order to put the water line in, and it was a degraded area, but it was a degraded area that's much more of this like sandy, spidery, gossamery soil than what had been a dairy pasture. So it was, and so I'm restoring it into a more durable biotope that will be correct for what it wants to be, which is a road next to the yurt. But I know from experience that we have far more ticks in the grass in the places that aren't so spidery and twinkly than the places where the spidery twinkly grass occurs on the farm. So and then you're saying kind of there's an easy thing to say, well, good or bad, or, but it's almost like what functional will are we imposing in these design choices, be they conscious or unconscious? And what is the cascade of effect? We're architects without quite knowing what we're doing, seems like.
Well, I think, yes, I think that's true. I think we don't know enough about how these processes work, but I think there's plenty that is known. And a lot of the time, I mean, think about it in a bigger picture. For as long as humans have been cultivating plants, we've also been cultivating soil microbiota. We just haven't called it that. We haven't realized that that's what's going on. You can't grow a plant without also growing soil microbes. When you fertilize a plant, you fertilize the soil microbes. When you tend the soil, you tend the soil community of soil microbes. So a lot of traditional agricultural practices take account of the life of the soil and the health of the soil and the regeneration of these communities without even knowing that they're doing so. And I think you don't necessarily always have to know exactly what's going on in this community to do something that's going to benefit it. So in traditional agricultural practices, you often find these things which just turn out to make total sense. Now, when you look at modern studies looking at mycorrhizal communities in agricultural fields, in organic agricultural fields versus conventionally managed fields, and sure enough, when you have lots of organic matter, when you don't have lots of inorganic nitrogen and phosphorus added, when you don't have obviously fungicides spread on the field, then you have much more healthy and intact and complex and resilient communities of mycorrhizal fungi. Of course, if you'd just been farming organically all along, you would have had that result without thinking about the fungi. So I think there's a lot we can learn from systems like Korea Natural Farming, which spent a lot of concern with these compost teas and these different ways of preparing, fermenting, nutrient preparations.
And capturing the culture, like setting out this nice yummy rice as kind of a lure for an ambient culture and then sugaring it up and bubbling it up and then transmitting it more broadly into the system.
Absolutely. And I think that then we follow on with this analogy of, you know, feeding soil and feeding ourselves, and, you know, some of the best foods that we can eat, some of the most delicious and healthiest foods we can eat are those that have been fermented. And it seems that it's similar with the way that we feed crops and soil communities. These fermented products are often very beneficial.
Well, you know, everything is sanitizing and sanitizing, and as the, you know, we're hovered over by drones of sanitizing race in our civic areas, and all those subways are wiped down, and I eat my apple with my grubby fingernails, I start thinking, gosh, being inoculated with the microflora of the garden is this a unique privilege. Eating with dirty hands is a unique privilege to us farmers at this time, and that the microbiota, which is received through food, through the surfaces of our foods and vegetables and hands and animal noses, might, as we study further along, be a critical part of our intercommunication and of our immune response. And I think that's another area that maybe we're going to go study up in, is how does life learn to react to these novel pathogens, and if it can't speak with itself because it's being sanitized out of communion with other, is it going to learn as effectively?
No, the answer is a clear no, and it's becoming increasingly obvious that our immune systems have evolved not to keep out microbes, but to better regulate the populations of microbes that live within and on us. And your immune system simply can't develop unless it is in some kind of ecological conversation with microbes that live in you or around you. And so we already know about this increase in incidence of sanitization-related complexes, whether it be allergies or autoimmune complexes, that we already know about these problems that we've caused by underexposing developing humans to the microbial environment. And so it's a big, this is a major problem and will only get worse, it seems, under the current regimes. Of course, there's an irony because you can spray disinfectants as much as you like, but there are always going to be microbes somewhere around. You know, you can't ever fully sterilize a subway. It's just that you can, you constantly interrupt these ecological microbial cycles, and you're going to have microbes there. You just, there might be these sort of weedy species that can deal with your sprays. So it's a losing battle. It's just, and it's a shame when our efforts to rid ourselves of microbes to cure us actually could be generating all sorts of new problems further down the road.
Well, and socially distant weeding and participating in a helpful way in this failing, doomed eradication of the weeds that happens, especially in springtime, especially in domesticated landscapes that produce food, might be a very good thing for more people to join in doing, if only for their own selfish self-interest to get their own grubby fingers in their own grubby mouths, inoculating their
mouths. Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing, isn't it?
Come grub with us.
There's some great studies that show already that, that are already published, that well established, that kids that grow up with dogs have healthier microflora when they grow up. And people who grow up on farms, and that this exposure to outdoors is ultimately beneficial. And so, yeah, I think maybe you could find a whole new way to source farm help. It'd be a win-win. If people could come from the city, their sanity might improve, their stress levels might decrease, their immunity might increase, their health, their microbiome would increase, and then you get all sorts of help from all sorts of new people.
Yeah, and until we get the price of food to be a little bit more accurate, we could just charge for the microbial services. Well, Merlin, it's been a great pleasure. I don't want to impinge on your time because you have got such a lot of promoting to do, because he's been really successful. Everybody who reads it loves it, including Robert McFarlane and Paul Stamets and Jaron Lanier and Andrew Weil and Elizabeth Colbert. I mean, God, some serious top brains that read and thrilled at their reading of your learnings. And I think those of us who have any energy in the evenings will join them, join me, join you, join the Mushroom Kingdom. Thank you for this time. And I hope that you come and visit anyway sometime, and we could sniff my mulch pile together, and we could do an empirical experiment to see whether the euphoria is shared.
Absolutely, that would be wonderful. Thanks so much for having me, Severin, and I wish you all the best.
Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye to all of you. See you on the next episode of Earth Life. And goodbye.